Mr. and Mrs. Autism and all the ships at sea. You are listening to STEM for STEM, the relationship podcast by and for autistic people. We're back. The fuckers did another season of Love on the Spectrum, so we have been called back to action, and we're back. I'm one of your hosts, Zach Budrick. Who else is here with me tonight?
Hi, Charlie Stern, Paris Geller Stern, and Mr. Bird.
And we're very excited about our guest tonight as well. He's the creator of the webcomic Goats, and I believe the first ever winner of the National Cartoonist Society's webcomic category.
Yes, online comic, yes.
So, yeah.
That one was for Scenes from a Multiverse, though, the follow-up.
Right, right.
Yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm John Rosenberg. I've been a cartoonist for, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. I forget. And you can see me online at multiverse.com.
Welcome, John.
And why have Thanks. You come to us today?
Zach invited me to come on and talk to you guys since I am newly self-diagnosed. At 47 years of age, I never thought I was autistic my entire life. I knew there was something up, and I pursued, you know, psychological routes. I went to see psychiatrists and psychologists and other therapists, and nobody ever suggested it once. But after doing some research, it was the only conclusion that made sense. It was like that saying about how biology only makes sense in the light of evolution. Well, my particular mental issues only made sense in the light of this diagnosis. So it would be nice to have a formal diagnosis, but this is going to have to do for now.
Yeah, I actually do think that most of our listeners are going to be both adult diagnosed and also self-diagnosed.
Yeah, I did a lot of looking into the community before I came out and said that to make sure that there wasn't a stigma about that, or, you know, what the issues involved mm-hmm. were. You know, I read a lot about how difficult it was to get past the masking and other habits that people pick up over time, that those diagnoses are usually not accurate. So it didn't seem like it was really worth the energy or the time to pursue when it, you know, I have a long list of symptoms that match up to other stuff I've read. And, you know, to just show that list to a guy to say, yep, you're right, doesn't seem like, you know, I know it. I can tell. So.
And I think that's the greatest setup for us. Starting out in the pre-show conversations, we called this the rude one. It's actually, if you're thinking about Passover, you're thinking about the four questions, you're thinking about, you know, the child who does not know, the wicked child, you know, the child who cannot speak, et cetera, et cetera. This is maybe chaotic child who doesn't know, or neutral wicked child. Just because of how blunt it is. So I'll read it. What typically motivates people to get diagnosed in adulthood? I mean, if you're already 100% sure you're autistic, I don't really see the point of paying money to get diagnosed. And then, of course, they say, although maybe there are upsides to a diagnosis that I haven't heard of.
Maybe.
Well, thank you so much, whoever wrote this, because it was honestly valuable and entertaining in how rude it was. You know, whoever wrote this, you are so autistic. You know, like you fired this off
Confirmed.
In 20 seconds, hit send, didn't worry about it. And I applaud you. If you're already 100% sure you're autistic, I don't really see the point of paying money to get diagnosed. Okay, whatever. But to that, I answer from Twitter user Awesome Brandy. People who realize they are autistic do it because they've been searching for something. They've been trying to understand themselves, why they see the world the way they do, and looking for community. Why is that a bad thing? Why is someone feeling at home in their skin bad? So, you know, they obviously didn't write this tweet in response to this private email that we got. But I mean, I think that the attitudes surrounding adult diagnosis and self-diagnosis are really, really dismissive. And, you know, I just want to say, as someone who was an adult diagnosis and a self-diagnosis, you know something's wrong with you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You've known all your life that something's wrong with you.
Had no idea what it was. Didn't have a name for it, but knew there was something going on. You know, like, why am I walking on my toes? Why do I have all these food issues? Why can I not talk to people like they're people? You know, it's like, just all these questions, and there's one answer for it, and I didn't know the name of it until just recently.
And that's what makes it so freeing too. Like, imagine if you were learning a new language and there was just one word that you didn't know, but it was something that came up all the time. Like,
yeah,
imagine
certain emotion or discourse, yeah. Or, you know.
Yeah, like some people, ancient peoples didn't have a word for the color blue for the sky,
yeah.
Or something,
yeah.
Like that. Yeah, for something that common.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, I am sort of the odd one out here just because I was clinically diagnosed as a teenager, but I still understand just how freeing the knowledge is. And I'm just always so happy when I see someone come to that realization, whatever path gets them there.
I have felt more at peace in the last few months since the realization than in my entire life before that point.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's just to know that I am not imagining all this stuff. I am not lazy. I am not avoiding stuff on purpose. It's, you know, that there's a reason. It was a mind blower, and I'm still, every day I wake up and I go, holy shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. I just it changes everything, the way that you look at everything and my whole history. You know, I go back through every moment of my life and I realize from this new perspective what was happening and why, and it's just like constant lightning bolts to the head.
Yeah, something that was really interesting for me to hear was a couple weeks ago, for a piece that I also interviewed John for, I interviewed Yulin Nu, who is a member of the New York State Assembly and is herself autistic, and she said that a lot of it just kind of slipped under the radar for her as a child because it, like, didn't manifest in problematic ways. Like, it just meant that she was...
She's suffering internally and not in a way that bothered the people around her.
Yeah, all the people around her saw was that, wow, this look how great this girl's grades are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the issue, the reason so many of us go until adulthood to figure it out is because the diagnosis criteria for children is very limited, or
Absolutely.
Criteria is plural, so they are very limited. You know, basically the entire sort of medical community and all of media are focused on children who are boys, who are white, who present in, you know, Rain Man-esque ways.
Absolutely.
And that really fucks over all of the rest of us, who are the majority anyway.
Media representation hasn't helped us much in that regard.
Yeah, no. So, you know, it's very common actually to have grown up in either a gender minority or a racial minority, and having been autistic, having been in advanced classes or on the advanced track, but also wondering why you're not able to access the special ed tracks. Like, I specifically definitely yearned for both. I didn't know what was going on, you know, and all throughout my childhood, I was like, I don't know, like, I really am excelling at the advanced reading program, but I need the special ed program. And I couldn't verbalize that because I didn't know why I needed the special ed program. But I didn't seem to have these sort of intrinsic drives. I wasn't able to meet sort of informal development goalposts. Like I didn't know how people were adapting socially or knowing what to do in every situation. And of course my grades were super, super bad, eventually. And I was unable to complete work, because I was so anxious about it. I was such a perfectionist. I was in an abusive home. I had ADHD and undiagnosed physical illnesses, and I was autistic. And so I was like, I was just so panicked all the time because ostensibly I had everything there. I had everything going for me. I was supposed to have all the tools in my box to solve things and to get good grades and get myself out of there. But it was so, so hard. And it was like there was something in front of my face that I could see but could not see, and no one else could see. That just like was over my entire life, this veil. So, I mean, after going to college and being in college and being supported by my peers and all of us kind of like grouped together, all of the trans and queer people who were maybe on the spectrum, we all have since, you know, confirmed that we're autistic. But I wouldn't have been able to get there on my own. Yeah. You know, my roommate in college, sometimes when I was upset, she would bring me to Target. And like, that was her, like, as a childcare major, you know, soothing me, as an autistic person, you know, living in intimate quarters with her. And when I told her I had the realization that I was autistic, it wasn't quite I thought you knew, but it was like she knew. She definitely knew. And I guess she was just like, she hadn't thought to nudge me along. She was just she was responding to what I needed, but we hadn't had that conversation about why I needed these things. But of course, you know, she knew to take me to Target and let me touch things.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two people figured it out before me.
Yeah.
My friend Rich Stevens, who's also a cartoonist, he does a comic called Diesel Sweeties. Must have mentioned it to me offhand in a conversation a decade ago. And I dismissed it. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then my wife mentioned it to me a few years back. And again, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm just very depressed all the time. But that one stuck. And the reinforcement of the previous message. And eventually, I think that was what led me to start looking into it seriously.
You know, I was, for some reason, just thinking the other day about the first person who clocked me. And I think he was trying to insult me, actually. It's just... bigger kid in my neighborhood who kicked a paper cup of water out of my hands.
He kicked it out of your hands?
Yeah.
Shit.
And he said, are you autistic and that's how come you can't fight?
And was he doing like crane kicks or something? Was he, you know, was he the Karate Kid?
I don't remember any context other than the like visceral sensation of water suddenly being all over me. But you know what? You got me, guy. I'm autistic, and that's how come I can't fight. So next, we got both an email and a DM. Thank you both. Please continue to get in touch with us through either means. And the common thread is that both of them have long suspected that they're autistic. And that they have masked effectively enough that a lot of people don't even suspect that they are neurodivergent. I'm a 21-year-old non-binary person. I'm wondering whether I should pursue a diagnosis. I was diagnosed with ADHD, and I know there's a lot of overlap, but I have a gut feeling there's something more different going on. I've always struggled socially. I'm very outgoing, but I struggle to make real connections with people because I feel like we're not on the same page emotionally. My question is mostly for Charlie, but I want others' input. What made you decide to look deeper into whether or not you're autistic? Was there a tipping point where you decided you really needed to know? Our second question, very similar. I've been starting to consider that I might be autistic after I finished grad school last year. I'm a 26-year-old gay cis male, and I've been struggling on the job market. A diagnosis wouldn't be huge for me, but I think that discussing it might weird out my husband. He thinks that there's no utility in making it official since I really don't have many issues. I think that I mask most of my issues. While this is going on, my sister, 19, has been struggling with her mental health and flunked out of her freshman year at her university. Last month, she received an ADHD diagnosis. My mother and I believe that she's also autistic. While my diagnosis would be more for peace of mind, hers could be very important to get her proper accommodations and such. My mom is afraid of suggesting this to her out of fear that it will offend her, so I guess my questions are how best to bring this up to my sister, if at all, and how do I even approach getting a diagnosis for myself? I really don't even know where to start.
I'll start this off by saying that I think most of our listeners, and definitely most of our submitters, are of the same general demographic. So they are not people who have been diagnosed as children, and they're overwhelmingly queer in many ways. We see this again and again, and this is a huge indication that the medical complex is not serving us, and we are, I mean, anecdotally at least, we are the majority. You know, gender minorities, sexual minorities, racial minorities, you know, that's really who we are, and that's who the show is for. So, you know, I do want to answer this person's question because they indicated it was for me. What made you decide to look deeper into whether or not you're autistic? I mean, I think we all have that moment where we Google it. You know, it's funny because on so many crime shows, murderers Google, like, what do I do if I just murdered someone? And then they, like, read it. They read it in court because it's like, you know, please be careful about your online security. If you are doing crimes, whether or not you're doing, like, you know, righteous sabotage work, you know, as an anarchist or a communist, or you are self-performing abortions, or you are a sex worker, please, please, please be careful about what you're Google searching, because you don't want that read out in court. But yeah, no, like every murder show has like that 30 seconds of what this murderer Googled after murdering a person, or even before murdering a person, like how to poison a man aged 60 to 65. You know, like how long of a sentence does murder carry? So it's very human to throw ourselves down at the altar of Google. You know, and instead of asking God, we're asking Google. And so I think all of us have that moment where we are Googling symptoms. And even still, you know, as a person with OCD, I'm still learning, you know, that certain fears I have are like, you know, a certain kind of OCD. There are like ever expanding definitions, and five or six types that we know about now. And I'm still Googling.
I feel like I am the, yeah, I am the farthest removed from this, person's experience. So, John, do you have, any thoughts about, what made you, take the plunge as far as this goes?
Well, I mean, I've been looking for answers for decades, but I had never considered autism because my exposure to what autism is was very poor. I had seen, Rain Man and, a couple other bad representations on sitcoms or whatever, and I hadn't thought too much about it after that. But the last few years on Twitter, I've interacted with so many amazing autistic people that I had to reassess what that was and do research and find out about it. And over time, as I learned more about it, I realized I saw myself more and more in the things that I was reading. And after a while, it was just undeniable.
Yeah.
So it's I think it's really just the more you're exposed to it, the more you learn and the more you kind of can grasp what it is and how it manifests in your life. And yeah, it's an ongoing process for me.
Absolutely. And, even though I, again, was diagnosed as a teenager and by a doctor, I really wish that, I had, even now when I'm 32 and about a decade re or about 2 decades removed from my diagnosis, it's been, extremely enlightening and expands my understanding by the day to be able to, like, actually be part of that community. So, I think that I understand, myself in ways that I didn't just by getting that diagnosis, because I've been able to talk to and expand my understanding with other autistic people. So I definitely think that seeking out your people is extremely valuable in terms of coming to that sort of realization.
Yeah, and if the people you're spending time with are autistic, you probably flock to them for a subconscious reason, and you're probably autistic. I talk about my friend who is a rabbi a lot on this podcast, but knowing him in college, mere years before realizing I was autistic, he got his adult diagnosis. And being exposed to him and like also being surrounded by all of these weird people we later found out were autistic. We all flock together. And if you are listening to this and you're unsure, or maybe identifying as not autistic, there actually is a reason you're listening to this podcast. If you do have the question is probably yes. And if you are on Twitter in a lot of community with autistic people, autistic creators, autistic dot dot dot, whether you're in STEM or a politician or a journalist or whatever, if you're surrounded by autistic people and you have an interest, an unexplainable interest in autistic things, like that's kind of your answer.
I mean, Occam's razor, like the simplest explanation tends to be the correct one.
Yeah. So this younger sister, who is probably autistic, the proximity, both, genetically and socially, to you as our submitter. You at 26, your younger sister is very likely autistic, and she has also very likely been searching. I guess I could address both of these people here, 'cause it all sort of congeals. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. And I think that we don't know the specifics of how it runs in the family, but there is definitely a lot of evidence suggesting that as well. Like I've talked to so many autistic people who think that one or both of their parents is probably flying under the radar as well. Like there's been so many things that I've been noticing about my father. I was just recently, I think I told Charlie about this, my wife and I visited him for the weekend, and for some reason he was just like compulsively repeating his impression of the way Wolf Blitzer says the coronavirus to amuse himself whenever he was bored.
No.
Things that I've realized looking back over the years is that a lot of the people that I clicked with and ended up spending most of my time with were other artists who do exactly the same stuff as I do. You know, we would congregate at conventions and that sort of thing, and I am positive that at least half of those people are autistic. it's definitely like a community that attracts a lot of neurodiverse people.
Yeah.
Neurodivergent people, a neurodiverse community. Mm-hmm. I have to wonder if there's some overlap with just creativity in general there.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I think we have a lot of lost time to make up for as far as that goes, because like for years, part of the stereotype, like dating back to around the Rain Man era, or maybe a little afterwards, just was the idea that autistic people are all STEM lords. And
yeah.
But I know, like, I know a ton of creative autistic people and autistic people like with otherwise liberal arts background, and you know, it's, and I think that you know, things are far from ideal, obviously, which these questions illustrate, but I also think that we have a way better understanding of the extent to which autistic people contain multitudes, and that keeps people from like dismissing the possibility out of hand in a way that they might have a decade ago.
Yeah, there are great memes about like how if you were in the closet in high school, like your English teachers were really important to you. And I think, you know, that's definitely true for queer people, but it's also true for autistic people. If you had, like, a history teacher who, like, you kind of saw as a parental figure, something was going on inside of you.
I fell in love with any teacher who would give me, like, half a minute of attention. Yeah. They were, you know.
See, and just for the audience's benefit, Charlie did not know until I'm saying these words right now that I had a history teacher who was like a parental figure in high school.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Clocked.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's incredible. Because it really is true. You know, mm-hmm. it is true for many, many demographics. And, yeah, I mean, I don't remember my science teachers valuing, you know, my emotional well-being.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's an entirely different culture. STEM autistics, I don't know, write in. Do you feel not so supported by your peers and mentors? Because the stereotype of STEM would lead me to believe that your mentors aren't as emotionally giving. I hope that's inaccurate, but, you know, write in.
Yeah, always write in. Okay, so this one says, I've been reading more and more about autism over the last year after my ex, who is autistic, told me they thought I might be too and asked if I'd ever talked to anyone about it. Reading more and more, talking to my autistic friends about their experiences, I've come to feel pretty confident that both I'm autistic and that my deceased father was as well. I also think I've spent the vast majority of my life masking, and that it's very hard to let that down around strangers because I'm so used to needing to do it. I'd like to reach out to someone for an official diagnosis, but I'm concerned after reading about it that I'll end up talking to someone who's going to misread my masking and not be able to give me helpful information or feedback. I'm 33 now, and while I can find lots of resources for children seeking diagnosis, I'm coming up short for whom to speak to as an adult. Do you have any recommendations, and how much is masking a barrier to diagnosis?
So obviously we're not therapists and we're not psychiatrists or psychologists, and we don't have these answers, and also, well, our country, if you're writing from the United States, doesn't, you know, have a lot of resources for you, but they do still exist. You know, my temptation is actually to schedule an appointment for when you're exhausted and stressed out. Like, if you only like to do your doctor's appointments in the afternoon, like I do, you know, if I was trying to take the barriers down and not be masking, I would go first thing in the morning when I'm not woken up enough to get the shields up, basically. Yeah. Or if you work a 9-to-5, go directly to your appointment after you're at work, because you're probably going to be really wound up. Or, you know, if you have other medical things going on, doing like a marathon of like one or two medical things or other errands or whatever, like, honestly, I think it might be worthwhile, whatever strategy you decide to take, to like go in a little stressed out, go in a little impaired in some way. you know, so you are not this confident person going into an interview. You are a patient seeking help and, you know, clearly suffering from whatever you are looking to solve, and that's why you've come to a doctor.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. And this was autism and anxiety are not apples to apples, although they tend to be correlated. But like, for years, this is why I resisted going to therapy for anxiety, because I'm never actually in therapy when I feel the most anxious. Mm-hmm. And yeah. It's because you can't put that exact headspace into words when someone is actually asking you to. So I think that's a really good idea.
Do you feel like when you go to therapy, you're trying to give the best impression of yourself?
Sometimes, yeah. And that's honestly, I think that having I feel like a weird gotta be strong. My therapist is a man, and I feel like, yeah, Sometimes there are like, he's great at his job, but also I feel like this weird like gotta be strong for my dad when I talk to him as a result of that.
That's why it's so difficult to find a good therapist. It's so hard to find someone who you feel is really on your side, really has your best interests at heart, and is not trying to put you in the, you know, the holes that he's learned about in, you know, his education or it's very difficult. I personally don't know what to do. So yeah. Anything you guys can suggest?
Well, no. You have to make the therapist interview for a spot with you, basically. Mm-hmm. You have to shop around. And if you don't vibe with someone after the first session, or even in the middle of the first session, they're not the one. You find the next.
Absolutely.
So, listeners, I've got the toy box next to me. So Mr. Bird and Paris are in the toy box. And, you know, Mr. Bird plucks himself, so he doesn't really have long tail feathers. But Paris has long tail feathers. So he's playing right now. He's got his head down and his butt up. So what I'm doing is fucking with his tail feathers. Just because it's bothering him and it's funny to piss him off, because he's really serious about playtime. He is very Paris Geller-esque, where if he is focused on a task, you know, God help you if you get in the way. He's very Jewish. So he's in this corner right now playing with like some like pinata-esque thing. A lot of these toys in the toy box were given to him by our late friend, Carly Caldwell. She was an autistic person working on staff at a North Carolina center for autism outreach, basically. She got diagnosed at work. She always had the suspicion, and then working in that environment helped her to, you know, come to terms with herself and get a diagnosis. And, you know, she knew everything about birds and rabbits. She rescued many rabbits down on their luck. And so she was thinking of starting to get birds. And so she would give Paris very lavish gifts, you know, candy bars and pinatas and little pear-shaped flavored vitamins. And I mean, we care on this podcast because of those we've lost. And that's a huge theme. But right now, you know, as we speak, Paris is tearing into this pinata that Carly gave him. And hell, that yeah. feels nice.
Absolutely. She is actually out camping with Rachel in the Gettysburg area this week. But this is the first time we've recorded since we got our Chihuahua Ziggy. So given how difficult it is to get her to understand that anything at all can't be done while playing with her, she may make a cameo in a future episode.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had to... Like, prepping for this, obviously, like, setting up my very old laptop and trying to get it online, I had to keep, foofing Paris from like, you know, I'm doing a demonstration for everybody in the video chat, but basically he was putting his feet and his tail over where the camera hole is, and also trying to chew on it, like, get inside. So I foofed him from the top of the laptop to my head, and then he'd fly back, and then I have to do it again. It was a whole process, and it took taking a hot shower to calm both of us down to get ready for this podcast.
It happens. Sometimes you need a Paris shower.
Let's go to our decompression question.
So, obviously, fall is in the air. I don't think any of us is in exactly the same area, but it's my understanding that it was fairly brisk in a lot of places today, especially compared to earlier this week. So, you know, since autistic people are, you know, very much about the familiar sounds and vibes and smells, and fall has all of those, we are asking, you know, what is your go-to seasonal drink? So I am not really like an elaborate Starbucks drink person, just because I feel like I have an old man's palate that can't tolerate really drinking sugar. But this is such a bougie thing to say, even more so than talking about your favorite Starbucks drink, but they got pumpkin coffee at Trader Joe's that I will just pound black, no cream or sugar in it, during September and October. And, you know, it works really well for me. Like, I am just feeling, again, that nip in the air and taking a big sniff of it like a sicko, that just works out really well for me.
Is it ground coffee with spices in it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. They got a holiday one that I really fuck with as well, but it's too early for them to have that out.
John?
I'm not much of a coffee drinker. I actually don't drink any coffee. I don't, the taste of it, I can't. It's like, maybe it's a sensory thing. I'm not sure. But ever since I was younger, I've tried it many times, but I've never really taken to it. I do, on the other hand, enjoy sugary stuff. I'm a bit of a sweet tooth, a bit of a sugar addict. So, you know, you give me a Red Bull and I'm a happy boy. But for the season, you know, my go-to would have to be hot cocoa. I mean,
Love
it's,
a
you know,
hot
it's a
cocoa.
classic, especially if you got some marshmallows going on.
Yeah, all of mine are coffee too. Right now I'm thinking of bulk buying the Califia Farms pumpkin spice almond creamer because I've had that for a couple weeks and it is incredible. And I know I'm gonna have like one of those like autistic sads about it if I run out
Sure.
when pumpkin spice season is over. So I think what I'm gonna do is bulk buy and freeze and then thaw if I need because yeah, the ritual of coffee is so important to me.
Absolutely.
I just bought a nice French press and I can't wait for that. I have been doing like Keurig, which isn't bad. People give it a lot of shit, but it's not bad if you do the refillable cups and put in your own, premium coffee. But yeah, I think I'm gonna bulk buy the Califia Farms, and that's what I'm gonna do until, next summer rolls around and I'm forced to drink lemonade or whatever.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned. I feel like it is enough of a thing that we need to do like a bonus episode or something about it, about the phenomenon of autistic running out of something sads and
Yeah.
autistic choosiness about a specific kind of that thing too, 'cause like I have this specific like kind of instant peach tea that I can only find at the grocery store where parking is impossible. So every time I say I'm walking out to buy more, Rachel says, "Let me just give you a ride to the other grocery store." And I'll say, "No, you can't give me a ride to that other grocery store. They don't have it there. I'm walking." And sometimes I feel like it probably doesn't taste any different. Like I just like reverse engineered the choosiness in some perverse way, but I don't know.
No, I am so attached to the Nate Berkus Project 63 sheets, bedding. I got a queen set in 2019. Then for a while I had to adapt to a twin bed because the place I was subletting had like a day bed. So I bought the same sheets I already owned but in a twin from eBay. And then I started sleeping on a full frame and a full mattress, and I bought two different sets of those same sheets in the same color from eBay. And if I can't change my mattress size anymore, I have to keep this mattress or stay with full because if I didn't have these sheets, of course I would die. I would literally die. What would I do? I would die. So yeah, either Target needs to bring them back or I have to guard these sheets I already own with my life.
Hell yeah. Yeah, and it's bedding and sleep related stuff in particular, because that's like you that when you're at your most vulnerable. So
Yeah.
the idea of something not being just right.
Yeah, and I think we had requests for like skincare for us to talk about skincare. So I think you guys next episode, let's get our submissions in. We're gonna talk about skincare, bedding, cooking, laundry. We're going to talk about developing skills. As autistic people, a lot of our listeners are younger than us. So yeah, what we're going to talk about next time is just, you know, trappings of the home and of oneself. So
hell yeah,
write in at stimforstim@gmail.com or just DM us on Twitter, because all of you, I think, found us through Twitter.
Mm-hmm. We're back.
We're back. Season two.
Hell yeah. And John, where can people find you online?
My website is at amultiverse.com, or you can find me on Twitter at John Rosenberg.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, and we will see the rest of you next time. Mm-hmm.